Hello, and welcome to Justice Above All, a quarterly series about the evolution of and continued need for racial justice advocacy. This podcast series is brought to you by the Thurgood Marshall Institute of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, which has been separate from the NAACP since 1957. I am Keisha Moore, Senior Researcher at the Thurgood Marshall Institute, and I am thrilled to be joined by three accomplished experts who are here to help you navigate the worrisome, confusing, and ever-changing landscape of school reopening. The Black community is currently reeling from three devastating pandemics: the public health crisis of the coronavirus, the economic impact of shutting down the economy, and the enduring reality of structural racism. These compounding impacts of these pandemics generate severe trauma and magnified inequality for both Black students and their families. Now, prior to COVID-19, there were already significant racial differences in access to educational opportunity. So how should we respond and reopen schools in a way that addresses these racial inequities and the trauma experienced by Black students? How can school districts do a better job of fulfilling their responsibility for a safe and equitable education for all? And how do we ensure that Black parents do not have to choose between the health of their family and the education of their children? Our distinguished panel of experts have gathered here today to help us answer these and other questions identified by Black parents. Before we begin the discussion, let me take a minute to introduce you to our outstanding panel. We are joined today by Dr. Brooke Cunningham, MD, PhD. Dr. Cunningham is a general internist, a sociologist, and an assistant professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at the University of Minnesota. We are also joined by Dr. Janice Parker, PhD. Dr. Parker is an assistant professor of school psychology at the William and Mary School of Education, a licensed psychologist, as well as a nationally certified school psychologist. And finally, we are joined today by Ms. Monique Lynn Luce, Esquire. Ms. Lynn Luce is a senior counsel at the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. To each of my guests, welcome. It is such a pleasure to have you here with us today. Now, before we begin the Q&A, I want to make it clear to our audience that we are not giving out medical or legal advice. Today's conversation with our panel of experts is designed to help you better understand what a safe and equitable reopening of schools should look like. So let's begin our conversation with you, Dr. Cunningham. I'd love it if you could help us understand the science around children's vulnerability to the coronavirus. I've heard a lot of different things. Some of the things that we've heard are that kids are not likely to get the virus, or if they get it, they can't transfer it to other people, or they might have less severe impact from the virus.
Yes, thank you for having me. I welcome the opportunity to discuss this. So what we've all heard, particularly in the press about children, we heard early on that children seem to be less at risk. Now, we have to be clear about individual risk versus risk at a population level, right? Because yes, at a population level, it does seem to be bearing out that children do seem to be less at risk. There's some hypotheses about why, including that children may have less of the receptors just because of their developmental stage, right? They're still growing. That they may have less of the receptors for the virus to attach to. So it is seeming in this data, but again, we are in uncertain times, but it is seeming that they are less likely perhaps to contract COVID-19, and children under 10 particularly less likely to transmit it. But I'm trying to also lift up the difference between individual health risk and population health risk, because while that is true, right, on a population level, that the disease is seems to have lower prevalence, that means lower numbers in the population, for your individual child, the impact of the disease could be different. I will say, just talking about prevalence, that out of the, we're at about 3.8 million cases of people who have tested positive for COVID-19, and only 6% of those cases are children. And within that whole population, so I did the calculation, 6% of 3.8 million is about 216,000, if I did that calculation right. And what we're seeing in terms of multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children is the latest CDC information shows that there have been about 342 cases of that multi-system inflammatory syndrome. So it's relatively rare, but it's serious, right? If your kid gets that component of this viral syndrome, and that multi-system inflammatory syndrome often comes weeks later than the infection. Many children are asymptomatic. Many of them seem to perhaps have lower viral load, which means lower transmission. And from what we can tell, when there have been outbreaks, children do not seem to be the index case. Like, they don't seem to be the one who got it first and spread it to a whole bunch of other people. Mostly children are getting it from somebody in their household. And then briefly, and feel free to follow up with additional questions to make sure I've covered everything, but briefly, yes, with this multi-system inflammatory syndrome, which, just so that your listeners know, what that looks like is, again, high fever for usually multiple days. Often children will have a rash that corresponds with that fever. Children often will get GI symptoms, so gastrointestinal symptoms like abdominal pain, vomiting, and diarrhea. Sometimes they'll have red eyes or conjunctivitis, a very red, what we call a strawberry tongue appearance, and swelling in their hands and feet. But the key things are really this fever. And again, it's multi-system. So what's troubling is that it can affect your heart. You know, when we think about COVID-19, we tend to think about the respiratory symptoms, but for people, it does affect their heart. And we see that in the multi-system inflammatory syndrome. In addition to their lungs, it can cause acute kidney injury, because just your inflammatory system is just revved up with the infection. And so that is really something to be mindful of. And we are seeing that more in children from racial and ethnic minorities. But part of the reason we see that is just, right, if the risk to children of contracting COVID are the people around them, the adults around them specifically, right? We know, you know, the news is telling us every night that Black folk, in particular, and other racialized minorities are at disproportionate risk because of the rate of comorbidities, so like hypertension and diabetes in racial minority populations, because of socioeconomic disadvantage, and circumstances that put us at risk, including being essential workers, right, in terms of not being able to get off work or not having sick leave or being at risk, feeling at risk of job termination, or actually just needing that check, right? Needing the money, right? Because you got to need to eat. Also, because of the economic ramifications of structural racism, we also have to think about wealth and income disparities and likelihood of being perhaps underinsured. And then recognizing that these, even though the legislation is supposed to cover costs of testing, they might not cover costs of hospitalization or other ancillary tests. So people are concerned about money. And also we have to acknowledge that there has been, studies are showing some bias in testing in terms of who is getting offered the test when they want it. So so racial and ethnic minority children and Black children are at risk, right? Because they're the adults in their lives are at greater risk.
And thinking about the indicators that we want to look towards to help us determine, you know, if it is safe to, in fact, send our children to in-person school, what are some of the public health measures that we as parents and concerned citizens should be monitoring in our local community to know, you know, whether it is appropriate to reopen schools in brick and mortar form at this time, given the variability of COVID infections around the nation?
Right. I think this is the tough question. And this is anxiety provoking, particularly as we're seeing these sort of surges in lots of communities. And unfortunately, the things that, you know, if we could have our druthers, if we could have sort of the public health infrastructure, and if we could have the technology advanced, you know, we would have probably high levels of community surveillance of symptomatic and asymptomatic people, right? Because what we're seeing in the news are the symptomatic people, right? Those are the folk who are most likely to get a test. Many asymptomatic people are not being tested. And even if they want a test, I will tell you still as a person who provides adult care, many asymptomatic people will not be tested because sort of the public health guidance in many communities, including my own, is very narrow for asymptomatic people. Meaning really if you've had somebody in your household with COVID or around somebody who has COVID-like symptoms, but it's sort of not to the point that in every community can every person get a test. So we don't really have a lot of the background information, and I've seen different numbers about percentages of asymptomatic people ranging from, you know, estimates of 15% to up to like half, you know, 45-50% of people being asymptomatic and potentially, you know, and still shedding virus. And so we have no great understanding of that. And so what we really need to push and what I really do hope that happens is greater community surveillance and hopefully the development, and I know these are underway, of point of care tests that are reliable and affordable, where you get an answer immediately about does this person have COVID, yes or no? And that, again, that are very good in terms of sensitivity and specificity that give us, you know, low false positive and low false negative sort of rates. So I think, you know, we don't have that. And so I don't know that there's good sort of community level data at this point that you can make a judgment on. I do think you can start paying attention to some things that are happening within your schools. And really, I know school administrators across the country are paying a lot of attention to the things that they can do, you know, right within their scope to mitigate risk.
And what I appreciate about what you're saying is that our ability to even understand how risky it is really requires that we engage our larger community, our policymakers, in getting the kind of community surveillance for asymptomatic and symptomatic people, as well as the kind of the work you were talking about in terms of point of care testing. Because without those, we really are kind of making guesses about how safe or unsafe it is in a reopening. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that is accurate. I mean, asymptomatic transmission is real from everything that I can tell, and we just have no idea of what the prevalence of asymptomatic carriers of COVID is.
So I'd like to turn the conversation and include Ms. Lynn Moose and also Dr. Parker here and thinking about the kind of safety protocol. So we recognize that there isn't a way for us to very definitively say how much risk is available in our community. However, regardless of how much risk there is, we want to make sure that we're doing maximum safety protocols for our children if we were to send them back to in-person school. So if I would like to start with you, Ms. Lynn Luce, and then we'll move on to you, Dr. Parker, if you could talk about what we as parents should be expecting to hear from in terms of communications from our school administrators about the safety protocols.
Absolutely, thanks you for having me. So I think that when it comes to this question of when will it be safe for students to go back for in-person instruction, I think one of the first things that comes to mind for me is that in-person instruction is the gold standard, right? It's not replaced by virtual instruction by any means. And so making the decision to keep children home, you know, should be based, given the utmost care and taken as seriously as possible, and also that all steps should be made to ensure that students can attend in person. Where the issue comes in, and as the has been discussed, right, is that the community may not be in a place to allow students to go back to school. One of the things that parents should be looking for is, one, what is the state guidance where you are, and what is the state suggesting should happen? What are the options the state's providing? Two is to look closely at your school's reopening plan. And a couple of things that should include is, one, the ability to adjust and be responsive to changing circumstances. One of the things that's apparently clear to everyone is that things may be in one place and then a week later, 2 weeks later, a month later, the circumstances have changed, right? There's more community spread, hospitals are stretched thin, and so adjustments need to be made. What's important, however, is because children need to have continuity, is that school districts are equipped with a plan for what happens when one student gets sick, if a whole school gets sick, if the community gets sick, how will they transition from in-person instruction to distance learning, or if they start the school year in distance learning, but later it's possible to have some in-person, how will that transition happen? The second thing you should really be looking at is, how are they planning to deal with social distancing? And thinking through, and this is important for the whole school, but also for your individual child, thinking through what will be your child's points of contact. What are they doing to ensure the social distancing for your child? What will meals look like? What will classroom changes look like? Where will teachers be? Will students be moving around? Will there be the proper facilities for hand washing? So one of the things I think to note is that even if schools aren't opening now, before the end of this COVID pandemic, some schools may be in a position where local circumstances say it's possible to reopen. And when that happens, there should be a plan in place that follows what the best public health guidance is, and that has the necessary provisions to ensure that children have seamless transition between whether there's a school closure again or schools open up again. It should be possible for students to be able to maintain continuity, both with their instructors, with curriculum, and also with their classmates.
Thank you. That's very helpful. And I really appreciate you emphasizing that in-person schooling is our gold standard. And so for lots of reasons, we want our children to be able to be educated in person, and we want them to be able to do that safely. Dr. Parker, I'd like to invite you into the conversation to talk about emotional safety and what that looks like in terms of reopening. So, you know, we recognize that there is a strong mental health consideration involved in reopening. And if you could help us to think through what are some of the things that we should be mindful of and we should look to our schools to think through with us about supporting students in the transition either into and out of in-person schooling around mental health and emotional safety.
Sure. So one thing I wanted to note, so the National Association of School Psychologists and the American School Counselor Association, they just put out a very good thorough kind of guide around the same topic, so socio-emotional support as we think about, you know, supporting students during COVID. And so I think broadly, one thing we really want to be aware of and, you know, perhaps ask our school administrators and school leaders, is what supports are going to be put in place to support students' mental health and socio-emotional well-being. So, for example, what is the school's plan for identifying students who may need additional support? Will students be given the opportunities to discuss how they're feeling and experiencing the challenges related to COVID? And if so, who's their point of contact? Is it their classroom teacher? Who will kind of be that first line of check-ins? Is it the school counselor, school psychologist, school social workers that parents should perhaps kind of consult with and so forth? So there needs to be a clear kind of description of, one, who's the point of contact if my student needs some additional support? And then two, what does that look like? So right now, because of COVID, you know, there's a lot of discussion around telehealth, and that's where, you know, counseling support, counseling, psychological consultation can occur, you know, via these technology-based platforms. And so in lieu of being careful with social distancing, you know, what's the school's plan around that particular piece? And these are really important questions to ask because our students are struggling. They're hurting. They're trying to make sense of it all. And those conversations have to be a part of the dialogue alongside the physical safety. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, my colleague, Dr. Natoya Haskins, and I, we're conducting a qualitative study right now where we're interviewing African-American adolescents around the challenges related to COVID and how they're coping. And one thing that we keep hearing from students is that we wanted more check-ins, whether that's from their teachers or their, you know, school counselors, school mental health professionals. We wanted more individual check-ins, just someone saying, how are you doing? How are things are going? And then if needed, how can we link you up with any type of support that might be available? So I think that's really important. I also think it's important to kind of think about bullying and in particular normalizing, you know, wearing the face mask and so forth. So my cousin, for example, you know, she's making a decision to send her middle schoolers back to school. And she said, well, you know, if you're going to go back to school, you have to wear, you know, the face mask and the coverings. And her children were like, no, you know, that's not cool. You know, peers are going to pick on us for it and so forth. And I think that's something that's really important to consider from a developmental perspective. You know, how are students reacting to one another around these safety protocols? And what does that mean for supporting, you know, socio-emotional health? And then I think at the individual level, it's definitely important to know your child, right? So look for signs of distress. So for younger kids, we may see more regression. So for like our kindergarten students, you know, bedwetting, maybe more clinginess to adults in their environment. Older kids may kind of engage in things like work avoidance, withdrawal. Perhaps they may express excessive worry. So those are things to really look for in your children. And just an overall change in kind of behavior to determine, one, you know, perhaps they need some more additional support, and then kind of moving that conversation forward, really looking at ways to help them identify coping strategies to adjust to all of the challenges and changes.
I'm so glad that you brought up the kind of emotional and social dynamics that are associated with wearing masks. I hadn't thought about bullying as a potential outcome, but it makes sense. And I know I've heard some questions from parents about, particularly for young kids, the idea of wearing the face mask might interfere, like they can't read emotions. And I think this would also be true for students who have some developmental disabilities and rely a lot on the kind of facial signaling back and forth, and also just in general, how those kind of, how the barriers of the face mask might influence students' socio-emotional growth and their relationships with their teachers, their bonding with teachers and peers. So could you just talk a little bit more about this new phenomena of wearing masks and how that might influence the trajectory of our, what we think of as normal social emotional relationships and interactions?
Yes, yeah, I definitely think, like I mentioned before, that normalizing, you know, that it's okay to wear masks, and not just kind of think it's okay, but really taking the time to explain to our, you know, students why these mechanisms are in place. And I think, you know, we look at this, all the dialogue happening on social media, right? And there are people with very strong opinions on both sides related to, you know, mask wearing. And I think we have to kind of face the reality that those conversations, those messages may trickle down to their kids, right? And so when they're coming into the school setting, what happens when you have friends or those that are not friends that have these strong opinions related to, you know, protective gear, and what does that mean for social interactions, social relationships, students kind of conveying their opinions and perceptions on both sides. So I think that has to be, again, part of the conversation where we're thinking about supporting students' social and emotional growth. One, you know, again, we're explaining why the masks are in place, but also maybe helping our youth kind of navigate those conversations, knowing that there are different perspectives that very, very much so may trickle in the school setting. And how do they handle those different perspectives to avoid conflict and so forth?
That's very helpful. Ms. Lynn Luce, I'd like to invite you to help us think through the social distancing protocols and discipline. So we have seen situations in the news where particular police districts that are responsible for implementing safety and enforcing social distancing protocols, how it can quite easily turn into punitive policies from interactions with the police. So what can we do or think about? What kinds of conversations should we be having with our school districts in order to ensure that these protocols that we're setting up to keep our children and our staff safe don't become punitive policies that further would traumatize students? And again, we know disproportionately Black students get subjected to punitive discipline policies. So could you help us think through those issues of discipline and social distancing?
Absolutely. So I think one of the things that is really important about the return to school and the return to school in person or distance learning in any context is that schools really need to rethink how they're going to meet the behavioral and social emotional needs of students and how that intersects with their expectations for behavior and the consequences of not meeting those expectations. It's really important that you mentioned the way in which sort of policing of social distancing, you know, it's had a disproportionate impact on Black and brown people. And what's so telling about COVID-19 and the pandemic is that it has further entrenched and revealed sort of the disparities that were already existing. So Black and brown people are already over-policed. And so when you add in social distancing, you would anticipate that they would also be over-policed in that context. The same goes for school discipline, right? It has been well-documented and well-researched that Black students are more harshly penalized for developmentally appropriate misbehavior and oftentimes for subjective misbehavior. And it's not the case that Black students commit more misbehavior, it's just that they are punished more for it and they're punished more harshly, especially with out-of-school suspensions and in-school suspensions and expulsions. And so when we add a new layer of expectations to behavior, which is, you know, wearing masks and social distancing within school, that has to somehow be enforced and monitored, it's really important that schools are starting from a place of sort of reimagining what school discipline looks like and how to have a positive school climate and culture. And they can't have that with school resource officers. You don't have a positive school climate and culture with excessive suspensions and exclusionary discipline policies. You have it through trauma-informed care, through staffing resources with nurses and counselors and social workers and school psychologists who can actually meet the needs of students as opposed to just punishing them. And so looking at the fall and looking at, you know, children returning to schools, it's really important, I think, for parents to take a look at their student code of conduct, to look at the policies that are there and to think about and to ask questions about how discipline policies will be enforced. I think I would suggest, and what, you know, I think a lot of people are calling for, is that there's a moratorium on suspensions, right? That it's actually a moment where schools need to give students some grace. Students have been out of school now for many, many months. They had a very disruptive end to the school year, and they experienced trauma. Black students, on top of that trauma, have been disproportionately impacted by the COVID-19's health and economic consequences, and on top of that, have been sort of living through these high profile incidences of police violence, which have, in nationwide protest and civil disobedience that many of them may have participated in, but also they may have both the collective trauma of that and also the personal experiences. So taking all of that into consideration, schools really do need to approach this school year and from now forward, really looking at students as looking at their whole being, their whole well-being, looking at ways to change their punitive practices and actually build in the necessary supports for students to have both, social and emotional success that will lead to academic success.
I really appreciate the kind of multidimensional approach that you've brought to this conversation. And I just wanted to circle back to Dr. Cunningham to ask you what you would like to add to the conversation to help us rethink reopening.
I think, and as uneasy as it is for me to be sort of aligned with the administration, I think the answer is that, on again, for the population, parents have to think about their individual child, but for the population, I do think we need to, if we can, reopen schools. And I do just want to take a moment to sort of highlight some of the things that have been coming up about disparities, particularly thinking about the school to prison pipeline, but other disparities and the ways in which schools do feel, for many children, unmet needs, right? And so part of the flip to the conversation is, for many of our children, is it safe not to reopen schools, right? And on one hand, there is the educational component, which, let's face it, there are a lot of assumptions that go into distance learning, right? Seemingly based on a model of two working parents, or maybe one working parent and one stay-at-home parent, or parents with resources, you know, that allow them to, again, work from home. So maybe they're not essential workers. Maybe they have a certain type of white collar job that allows them to be like parent, employer, employee, and teacher all at the same time. But if we think about many of the kids, and I have a pediatrician colleague who says for his kids, like what he's seeing is the parents are at work, right? And they are at home by themselves often. And so they're not having that adult supervision and the teaching because their parents are essential workers and they're out working. And just for us to think about the wraparound services that schools provide in terms of food, in terms of exercise, in terms of being a safe place, being a stable environment. Think of all the kids who have housing instability and who may be homeless. Think about the risk of unstructured time, not only like screen time and gaming and even like sex even, right? But also thinking about other things like the impact particularly on girls, right, who may be expected to help out more around the house or to help care for younger children instead of studying. And also, of course, we're all living under high stress, right? And so in times when there's more high stress, right, there can be increased rates of interpersonal violence. So again, I think I lean with the American Academy of Pediatrics and saying, you know, we do need to push, if possible, to reopen schools. I think we do need to have a high bar. And again, we can think about what we need in terms of community surveillance to say that we are not going to do that. And we need to also be creative, right? Because maybe for older kids, we let them stay out of school, right? Even though that unstructured time can be a problem. But, and for younger kids who seem to have less risk of transmission and overall seem to be having less intense or milder symptoms, maybe they go back. They're also, you know, it's hard to keep younger kids from, keep them social distancing. So we have to, my point is we have to get creative. And we have to keep in mind the needs of all students and all families.
I'd like to invite Dr. Parker into the conversation again to share some of her thoughts on this critical topic.
Yes, so I was just going to also kind of piggyback on what Ms. Lindus talked about and also Dr. Cunningham around, you know, bringing students back. And really just kind of emphasizing the importance of either student teacher or educator and student relationships. You know, we know from the literature that, you know, even when we're in brick and mortar schools on a day-to-day basis, there is such power in that student-teacher relationship as it relates to supporting students, motivating students, getting to know students to figure out, you know, what the needs are in this moment in time. And so when we think about kind of rethinking and reimagining schools, it's so important that, you know, we think about putting mechanisms in place, even with distancing, right? Even when teachers can't necessarily give their little ones a high five and a hug, or maybe they can't talk in close contact with the older individuals, but how are those relationships being built and maintained so they can get to know what the needs are, not just for the students, but the families as well, to kind of help alleviate some of the barriers that may interfere with students' academic and social-emotional growth during this time.
Excellent point. So we can really see schools as a window through which we can provide the necessary supports for students and families and helping us to weather the trauma and loss associated with the virus and all that's happened in our lives from there. I'd like to turn our attention to special education students, and I'm hoping Ms. Lynn Luce and Dr. Parker, you can really lead us in helping us to understand this critically important population, right? So when we think about the opportunity for special education students to learn virtually versus in person, you know, if you could help us understand what are the kinds of accommodations that we can expect for the times if students do have to come out of in-person school and need to be in school virtually, what kinds of ways could we still support them?
Thank you. I know this is a really important topic, and one, you know, I think it's kind of clear nationwide that students with disabilities were really the most underserved by the school closures in the spring. And one of the things, most of the schools were caught off guard and not equipped. I think one of the things that's important for all of these issues, but definitely for students with disabilities, is that schools, you know, now have the opportunity to prepare for how they will be able to maintain continuity of services and supports for students. And so those should be thought of and in place. One of the most important things that I would encourage parents to do with students with disabilities is to make sure that they're looking at what their state guidance is on special education during the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as to look for information from the Department of Education, which is a little bit more sparse, I mean, the Federal Department of Education. But the most important thing to know after you look at those things is that the IDEA, Section 504, Section 2 of the American Disabilities Act, all of those things, those still apply regardless of whether there is a COVID-19 outbreak or a pandemic. All of the laws are still in effect. All of the rights and responsibilities are still in effect. Like all things, they have to be modified if there are issues related to social distancing and the need for schools to suspend in-person instruction. One of the things that parents should consider is what would be the transition plans, or what would be the plan if they had to go to, you know, to be at home, and what would that look like? And school districts don't have to plan for that, but it's something that parents can ask for in their IEP team meetings. They can ask for a distance learning plan, whether it's put in place at the beginning of the school year or whether it's something that needs to be introduced at a later point in time. They should and could and can ask that planning be put in place for how services will be continued for students and how the school will be able to provide supports for students. The other thing to note, and I think going back to the beginning of this conversation, is what should parents be looking for in plans and what should be in plans. In-person schooling is the gold standard, and it is especially the gold standard for students with disabilities. And so school districts that have are in a local circumstances allow students to return should be prioritizing students with disabilities having access to in-person instruction, because those are the students that need it the most. And so that should be a part of how school districts are assessing how they will allow for some sort of blended learning or some in-person learning. The last thing I will say is that when school districts on this issue is when a school district shuts down completely and stops instruction, which some school districts did do in the spring of this year, they stopped having instruction altogether. That is the only circumstance in which the sort of rights and responsibilities for under federal law for special education and students with disabilities, that those are suspended. So it has to be no school for everyone or school for everyone. And as long as school is open for some students, it needs to meet the needs of students with disabilities and providing them their, you know, free and appropriate education that they're guaranteed by law. Given that, parents should continue to advocate for their students and to work with the school districts to find the best accommodations possible. For I know there's some concern too of, you know, children who are medically fragile or have you know, physical disabilities that make participating in in-person instruction during the pandemic more risky for them, that there also are accommodations that can be made and should be made for those students to have, if they need to stay at home, to have sort of the homebound instruction that they need. But no choice, as long as you're still sending your child to a public school, they have all of these protections that they're entitled to. And so with the exception of homeschooling, students should still be able to have access, whether it's virtual or in-person instruction. They should be able to have access to the services that are outlined in their plans.
And so when you think about, individual accommodations, of course, it's always on a case-by-case basis, right? So, for example, students will have different needs. So for our kiddos who may struggle a little more with sustained attention, these individuals may need more, extra time on assignments. They may need shorter assignments to kind of be able to be successful. For students who struggle significantly with listening or reading comprehension, maybe they need, technology aids such as text-to-speech. For our students with behavioral challenges or difficulties, they may need a more individualized behavior intervention plan that can be developed in collaboration with the family and home environment. And as I talked about before, telecounseling, so providing services of that nature, via these technology-based platforms. And another example would be our students who are on the autism spectrum. I know there's a lot of conversation in my field, that being other school psychologists, around, using social stories to make sure that they understand the implications of these changes and they understand how to adapt and adjust. So it's really going to be, to me, handled on a case-by-case basis in terms of what students may need. But one thing I think it's important to kind of highlight, as Ms. Lynn Lucius emphasized, is advocacy, right? So it's so important, to the best of, parents' abilities. I know there's so much right now, right? And I hate to say, oh, this is something else to add to one's plate. But to the best of your ability, especially right now, when you can reflect on when all the changes occur with online instruction and, how your students learn best or your children learn best in the school environment, any type of documentation or making note of, under what conditions are they successful? Under what conditions, are they least successful? What do you find might be helpful as it relates to what works for the individual child to get them to be kind of successful during the transition back to school? Or should schools kind of move to fully online instruction, what they may need in that capacity? And I also want to highlight, as it relates to advocacy, one thing that we know from the literature is Black families and other families of color, they may not be as likely to advocate for their kids. Not because they don't want to, not because they don't care, but because there could be a disruption in the relationship between the school and the family. Perhaps they had their own share of negative experiences when they were in the school themselves. Maybe there's not a welcoming environment for these families. And so those factors oftentimes become a barrier to Black families speaking out and advocating for the needs of their children. And so from the school side, we have to, be mindful of that in terms of how we can conveying communication and respect for families. And then one thing I would say for Black families who may be hesitant, if you can, find either a close family member, a community member who you trust, who may have, in-depth knowledge about these processes, who can serve as an advocate alongside with you. And so if you don't find that you have the right words to say, maybe you're hesitant and apprehensive, is there someone that you can partner with who can help you and empower you to kind of have that voice at the table for your children?
Thank you so much. This has been very helpful and a great reminder of us that, all children deserve high quality education, and our children with special needs still deserve the kind of individualized quality education that we've laid out in the plans for them. So, we understand the racial disparities in COVID-19 deaths, as well as the economic fallout from the pandemic. We understand that our children are, you know, watching television or participating in uprisings where they are vulnerable to sustained violence and the trauma that comes with that. So as parents and people who are caretakers of young Black children, what should we be looking for in terms of physical and behavioral activities in our children? And how can we best support them both in school and at home?
Sure. So I would say be intentional about creating opportunities for your children to share their feelings and to convey how they are feeling in relation to COVID. Some children may not want to kind of have extensive verbal dialogue, but there could be other ways, such as drawings and so forth, especially for our little ones. And so by creating those opportunities through, for example, family activities, it allows parents to understand what they're going through and then to have a conversation around how to cope. And I think that coping piece would be my last kind of bit of advice, if you will, and just help your children identify, you know, healthy coping strategies. I know there are a plethora of resources that are available online around self-care. So, you know, exercising within, you know, social distancing rules, maybe picking up a new hobby, you know, doing some things in the home environment, doing projects and so forth. And then I also would say reaffirm those coping strategies that may be more culturally kind of relevant. So, you know, one thing that we're hearing from the youth in the study that I mentioned that my colleague and I are conducting is religious and spiritual-based coping. For many African-American and Black families, that's a core part of our identities. And so, you know, students are talking about things like praying or kind of reciting their favorite scriptures that are uplifting and motivating and so forth. So just try to the best of your ability, I would say to parents, really tap into those healthy coping mechanisms, reinforce it, model it, show them how you're using those coping mechanisms, and let them know that it's okay to feel anxious and worried about what's happening.
Ms. Lynn Luce, what would you like to share with parents as our guiding nuggets of wisdom?
You know, I think Dr. Parker and Dr. Cunningham are probably best suited to address how to best support students and young people and children through the trauma that they've experienced. But what I would encourage as a Black parent, and what I have known working with Black parents and students for many years, is that, you know, Black parents care a tremendous amount about the education of their children. And in this moment, where there are so many decisions to be made about how schools should move forward and what education looks like and what public education looks like, I think that Black parents need to take every opportunity as they can, on top of all the other burdens that we have, to make sure that our voices are heard. In order to reopen schools this fall, whether we do it in person or whether we have it virtually, requires a tremendous amount of resources that right now schools don't have. And it's critically important that the voices of all parents, but definitely Black parents, are engaged both at the local level and the federal level and the state level, and really pushing for the necessary resources to be in place to ensure that students have the physical safety that they need, but also that there's enough staffing and supports for the emotional safety that they need in order to be successful.
And to you, Dr. Cunningham, what guiding wisdom would you like to leave with our parents?
Thank you. I agree with my co-panelists. And as a healthcare provider, I'll say a couple of things quickly. One, as we talk about self-care, remember to, as we take care of our children, we also have to take care of ourselves. Remember that clinics and healthcare resources are available. We're seeing a lot of people stay out of clinics, understandably, because they're afraid of coming into contact with others who have the virus, but remember we are here. And also in thinking about healthcare, please get a flu shot. The flu and COVID look a lot alike. And we know the flu shot is not 100% effective in everybody, but it will help us from both the individual and population health standpoint if folk get the flu shot. And particularly for young children, the risk of complications for healthy young children is higher from the flu than from COVID-19. So please, as we come into the fall, please get that flu shot.
Thank you. And to each of my guests, I want to thank you for such an informative and stimulating conversation. This has been great. I've learned so much. I know our audience has learned so much. And I want to thank you, our audience, for listening. So again, the information that's shared here is not to be used in lieu of legal or medical advice, but it is to support you in your decision-making and to support you in supporting your children. So this podcast was brought to you by the Thurgood Marshall Institute, an interdisciplinary center of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. Please make sure that you rate this podcast wherever you listen to it. And if you'd like to connect with us, you can connect with us on Twitter at NAACP_LDF. And you can also connect with us on Twitter at TMI_LDF. Thank you.